Okay, so we start with the salutation to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good morning, everybody. Did I tell you the story about this recorder? It's a transatlantic traveler. In December, I went to Copenhagen to participate in these conferences, not the COP15, but there were sideline conferences amongst representatives of different religions. You know, I took this recorder along with me. Then I participated one day in a panel discussion at this large theater. And on the table, I had the recorder to record the talks, my talk and the other talks. Then immediately after our panel discussion, this videographer from this old, it's called Odyssey Networks, wanted to do an interview with myself and several other people. And so we went out of the hall for the interview, and I left my recorder on the table. Then after the interview, which was about 15 minutes, I came back into the hall to get my recorder and the other things, and I saw that the table had been dismantled. And at first I was worried, what's happened to my recorder? Then I looked at the seat where I'd been sitting, and the recorder was on the seat. And so then I took it, I put it in my bag, and then this other monk, Bhante Buddharakhita, told me that when I had gone out, he took my recorder and put it on my seat. So I was confident I had my recorder. The next day I wanted to record some talks, and I turned on the recorder, and I got the message, card full. And I thought, that was very thoughtless of me not to check the amount of space on my card before leaving for Copenhagen. And so I didn't try to use the recorder during the rest of the trip. Then when I got back to the US, I wanted to clear up some space off the card by copying files into my computer. And so I hooked up this recorder to the computer and opened the directory. And I saw that some of the folders that I had were missing. In fact, all of them were missing. There were different folders. Then I played some of the files. A couple of them were in French. And I thought I must have turned on the machine while some people were speaking in French. So I deleted two of those files. Then I played some of the other files. There was an interview with an Indian Swami that I hadn't recorded. An interview with a monk from Thailand that I hadn't recorded. And I thought, this is very strange. Then I had a brainstorm. Probably an ordinary person would have thought of this more quickly. But before we went to the airport, we had bought some batteries, new batteries for the recorder. And I looked into the battery case, and the batteries there were of a different brand. And I looked at the recording card, and it was a different brand from the card that I had. So then I realized, even though it's exactly the same model, identical in every aspect of its appearance, that this is not my recorder. I thought, what to do? How to get my recorder back, which had recordings of maybe about 6 months of talks or teach classes on the Pali of the Pali commentaries, not available anyplace else. So I wrote to the organizers of that conference. I thought they could send out a global email link to everybody who attended the conference through them. And so I wrote to the organizers. I told them that I thought that I had the wrong recorder. And then they wrote back to me and they said they were very happy to hear from me, since they had been speaking at the conference to a French journalist who had complained to them that she couldn't find her recorder, and so somebody had turned it into the hotel, and she had checked at the desk of the hotel, and she got the recorder back, but when she opened it, the files were not hers, and she realized it was the wrong recorder. And fortunately, the people who organized it, this French journalist had given them her card. And so they gave me her contact information, and I contacted her. And then she said that she was very happy to hear from me. And so I sent back her recorder to her. And about 2 weeks ago, I got this recorder back, finally. So it's had a long adventure getting lost in Copenhagen, traveling from Copenhagen to Paris, from Paris to some little town in Normandy. It's done more European travel than I have. And over this long interval, I almost forgot how to use the computer. And over such a long interval without having classes, I've almost forgotten how to give talks on sutras. Okay, so anyway, we now come to sutta number 20. This is the usual way I begin, right? Sutta number 20 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Vitakka Santana Sutta, which it's translated as it's actually not a literal translation, the removal of distracting thoughts. The title Vitakka Santana actually refers to only one of the methods, of the five methods to be mentioned, in removing distracting thoughts. But for some reason, the compilers of the sutta chose that one method as the title of the sutta. But there's a counterpart to the sutta in the Chinese Majjhima Nikaya, and they give it the title Discourse on the Higher Mind, which seems more appropriate. Okay, so the sutta begins, the Buddha calls the attention of the monks. And then he says that when a monk is pursuing the higher mind, from time to time, he should give attention to five signs. Okay, we have two key expressions here. Okay, one expression is adicitta. Now, the word citta is what's normally translated as mind. So any aspect of our mind, thinking, emotions, volition, and so on, falls within the scope of citta. But when it has this prefix, adi, which sometimes it gives the sense of superior, higher, excellent, to form this compound or to form this expression adicitta. This has the meaning of the higher mind or superior mind, and this refers to the mind of samadhi, the mind of deep concentration. And so just by by being born as human beings, we all have citta, the mind that is the center of our being, and it's always present to us. But the adicitta, the higher mind, the excellent mind, this is something that we have to develop. It's not our natural birthright. And so what the Buddha, one of the areas that the Buddha teaches is the methodology for developing adicitta, for developing the higher mind. And this is done through the practice of what we call meditation, particularly samatha meditation, the meditation aimed at serenity, tranquility. Okay, the other word here, it's the word translated as signs. The Pali word is nimitta. I'm not sure that signs is such a good translation, because a sign, we usually think of it as, you know, when you come to Chuanyin Monastery, the sign says entrance, or you see a road sign one way, parking lot. But this is not a sign in that sense. So maybe we could just say, put it more simply, he should give attention to five things, five matters. But in fact, sometimes I even suspect that the text has gotten garbled and the word nimitta has got put in here, even though it doesn't belong here. It seems to me that it should have been, he should give attention to five dhamma, to five things, five principles, five guidelines. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to explain these five ways of training the mind when the mind gets distracted from its meditation object by some kind of distracting thoughts, unwholesome thoughts. Okay, so first the Buddha says here, when a monk is giving attention to some sign, here the word again is nimitta. And in this place, the word nimitta seems appropriate, except that the translation sign might not be the clearest rendering. Here nimitta could be perhaps better rendered as object or theme or topic of meditation. So when the monk is giving attention to some object of meditation, and owing to that object, there arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, connected with hatred, connected with delusion, then he should give attention to some other sign or some other object connected with what is wholesome. Okay, now, the meditation subjects that are taught in Buddhism, if they're attended to properly, they don't give rise to what is called evil, unwholesome thoughts or bad, unwholesome thoughts. So it doesn't actually come because of the object that these thoughts arise, but it's just because the mind is not able to focus properly, consistently, attentively on this object. Somehow the object doesn't engage the attention, and so the mind tends to stray away from that object and then it becomes overrun by what are called, I don't really like the word evil here, that's too strong. It's bad or corrupting, unwholesome thoughts. And then these unwholesome thoughts are said to be connected with any of the three bad roots, unwholesome roots. Here what's called desire is the same as raga, lust, or tanha, craving, or greed. Then thoughts connected with hatred, aversion, ill will, anger, and with delusion, confusion, perplexity, dullness, restlessness, doubt. So we could say that the thoughts connected with the three unwholesome roots pretty much correspond to the five hindrances. We have the five hindrances. What the first is sensual desire or craving. The second is ill will. So the first hindrance corresponds to thoughts connected with desire. The second, ill will, corresponds to thoughts connected with hatred. And then thoughts connected with delusion will cover the other three hindrances. The mind, which is overrun by dullness and drowsiness. The mind, which is overrun by restlessness or agitation. And the mind, which is bogged down or tied down by doubt and perplexity. Okay, so then the Buddha is recommending, it seems as the first remedy, he says, then he should give attention to some other sign or to some other object connected with what is wholesome. Okay, then he says, when he, that's the meditator, gives attention to some other object connected with what is wholesome, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hatred, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. Then with the abandoning of these thoughts, his mind becomes steady internally, it quiets down, it becomes unified, brought to singleness, and concentrated. The verb here is samadhiyati, which is related to the noun samadhi. So the mind is able to enter into samadhi. Then the Buddha uses a simile to illustrate this. It's just like a skilled carpenter who, if there is a rotten peg or a rough peg, say within a couch or some appliance made of wood, and so the carpenter wants to get rid of that rotting peg and replace it, he'll take a fine peg and then knock it with the hammer. And he uses this fine peg to knock out the coarse peg, which might be decaying, and then he can replace it with a new peg. And so he uses the fine peg to extract the coarse peg. And so in the same way, the monk uses this other meditation object connected with what is wholesome to knock out those unwholesome thoughts connected with greed, or with desire, with hatred, with delusion. And when he does this, then the mind can settle down and be concentrated. Now, even though the sutta, the way we have it here, is recommending, it seems to be recommending this method as the first method to use to overcome these unwholesome thoughts. But in my opinion, if one is, excuse me, mean, I don't like to be correcting the Buddha, but but I express my opinion just from my own experience that if one is meditating, say, on what has a primary object, like mindfulness of breathing, for example, meditating on the breath, and then some unwholesome thoughts start to arise, the first method of dealing with them, in my opinion, should not be to drop the primary object and then to take up some other meditation object. What I would say is that there are other methods that one uses in the initial encounter with these unwholesome thoughts that could be effective simply in dispelling them and bringing the mind back to the primary object. So say if one is focusing on the breath, then one finds that the mind has wandered off from the breath. One is either worrying about something that might lie ahead in the future, or recollecting either with pleasure or with regret something that happened in the past. Then the first response, in my opinion, Bhante, should be simply to note that the mind has wandered, and then immediately, gently but firmly, to bring the mind back to one's main meditation object. In this case, the breath, the rise and fall of the abdomen, whatever one is practicing. If that doesn't work, then what I would say in the second instance is to try not to pay attention to those thoughts, those distracting thoughts, and again bring the mind back to the primary object without giving too much attention to those distracting thoughts. But in my view, the place where this method becomes useful is when one finds that a particular, we call it defilement, a particular disturbing tendency is becoming prominent in one's thoughts. And so it becomes a persistent disturbance, a persistent distraction. Then what I would say is that one should put aside one's primary meditation object, and for a certain period, it could be like a week, several weeks, work on developing that another meditation subject which is directly opposed to that defilement which is causing the disturbance. And so within the Buddhist commentaries, actually this goes back to the suttas themselves, the Buddha explains some of the specific meditation subjects that are designed to be antidotes to particular mental defilements. And so usually we deal with these mental defilements by way of the five hindrances. And so it's said that if one finds that sensual desire, sensual craving becomes the persistent, as one finds it to be the persistent tendency or distraction in the mind, then one should develop what is called the asupa sanya, which means the perception of the unattractive, or literally the unbeautiful nature of the body. And here we have to remember the Buddha is teaching primarily monks and nuns, and so part of the monastic life is the observance of celibacy. And many of these monks and nuns will be young people, maybe in their late teens, early 20s, so sensual desire can still be fairly strong. And so as the antidote to this, he teaches this meditation on the unattractive nature of the body, because sensual desire arises, if we really sort of probe into it and analyze it, what sustains it is the perception of the body as being beautiful and attractive. And so to sort of counteract that innate perception or that instinctual perception or that deeply ingrained perception, what one does is to deliberately cultivate the perception of the body in its true nature beneath the appearances. And so one does this not with the body of an attractive member of the opposite sex, but one takes one's own body as the basis for investigation. And one looks into the body by way of, the suttas mention 31 parts, the commentaries add another part to make the neat 32 parts. So the 32 parts of the body. Did I go through this already? I did. So some of you might be getting bored with it. I'll just go through very briefly. One will take the parts like hair of the head, hair of the body, the fingernails, teeth, skin. So those are the outer parts of the body. Then one sort of cuts away or removes the outer parts and one looks at the muscles, the nerves, bones, bone marrow, then the internal organs, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, intestine, stomach, brain, and so on, the fluids of the body. And as one goes through this, again and again, one gets the perception of how the body is truly unattractive. And then this helps to counteract sensual desire. Initially, one begins with many objects, like 32 parts, but as one develops the meditation, one can just narrow it down to a few parts that are particularly prominent in one's perception. For example, one can just take skin, flesh, bones, blood. Then go back, blood, bones, flesh, skin. Okay, so this, when one practices it repeatedly, it doesn't mean that one is trying to cultivate a disgust or an aversion towards the body, but rather a realistic perception of what the body is like beneath the attractive appearance. Like sometimes I think even on the internet, maybe if you search through Google, I vaguely recall seeing this some time ago, they had photos of like top star Hollywood actresses just after they've woken up in the morning before they've put on their makeup. So you don't even have to focus on things like the heart, lungs, liver, and spleen, but just what does the face look like before the makeup goes on. Okay, so the perception of the unbeautiful nature of the body, that's the antidote to thoughts governed by desire or sensual craving. Then the antidote to hatred, ill will, is loving kindness or compassion. Then for delusion, this takes various forms, but this can require, for example, if it's dullness and drowsiness, then the perception of light, the meditation on a bright light. But never stare at the sun to get the image of a light. Better to use either the full moon or just to get an imaginary mental image of the sun, or the light of an electric light. Just to get a bright light and focus on that bright light to the point that floods the mind with light, and then that dullness and drowsiness disappears. And if there's a lot of restlessness, then the specific antidote is said to be mindfulness of breathing. And if one is having trouble focusing on the breath, then what one could do is the exercise of counting the breaths. So count the breaths from one, for example. In-breath one, out-breath one, in-breath two, out-breath two, up until 10. Then one could go down from 10 to 1, 1 to 10, 10 to 1. If one loses track of the count, then just go back to 1 and start over. Okay, so these are some of the methods that are recommended for dealing with these distracting thoughts rooted in desire, hate, and delusion. And we'll come to, maybe anybody have any questions at this point about this method? Okay, then we'll go on to the next method. Okay, now the text says, if while he is giving attention to some other sign, some other object connected with what is wholesome, that is the first method I was recommended. So if he's using that first method, and there still arise in him these bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion, then he should examine the danger in these thoughts thus. These thoughts are unwholesome. These thoughts are reprehensible or blameworthy. These thoughts result in suffering. Basically, this is the method, very much the same method that the Buddha himself used during the period when he was striving for enlightenment. The method that's explained in Sutta number 19, which I dealt with in our last class, I think it was February 13th. February 6th. Okay, so the way this method could be applied in a little bit more detail is the way that the Buddha reflects in Sutta number 19. One considers that these thoughts lead to my own affliction. They lead to the affliction of others. They lead to the affliction of both. They obstruct wisdom. They cause difficulties. And they lead away from Nibbana. Okay, so then when he examines the danger in these thoughts, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion are abandoned and subside, and then again his mind becomes steady internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Then the text uses a rather, say, a startling simile to illustrate this. We have here a young man or a young woman who's fond of ornaments, and then somebody ties the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being, probably the bodily part of a human being. Okay, ties this bodily part around their neck, say, and then they would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted by this. Sounds like something from one of these horror movies, right? And so in the same way, when these thoughts arise, then one develops a kind of revulsion to those thoughts. And one becomes sort of horrified to know that one is thinking them. And in this way, one abandons those thoughts. I have to say, I'm not so sure that I would normally advise this method, because it creates, maybe there's a tendency to create too much of an inner division within oneself. So I would actually put this method way down towards the end, maybe even grouping it under the last method, because it creates this kind of what I call a forceful inner division. And I think it's wisest to proceed in gentler ways at the outset, ways that don't create a sense of enmity or conflict between oneself and one's thoughts, but one could recognize the thoughts as being just sort of part of one's being, part of one's nature, things that arise naturally. And sometimes, you know, if one is practicing meditation intensively over a long period, sometimes the strangest and most bizarre thoughts can arise in the mind. So we all have within us maybe the serial killer, the autocratic tyrant who orders his subordinates to be taken out to the field and shot, the rapist, the seductress. All of these are, you know, just deeply ingrained tendencies in the mind. And if one goes pressing on the mind through intensive meditation, thoughts like this can come bubbling up. And so if one is always labeling them as being horrifying, humiliating, disgusting, repulsive, then one will get this feeling of enmity towards oneself. So what I recommend as a gentler approach is not to surrender to these thoughts, of course, not to go out into the field and start kidnapping children. Or beating up old ladies on the street. But just watch the thought, recognize this is part of human nature, and just let the thought arise and pass away. And in this way, one defuels the thought, one removes its sustenance. Again, one is creating a distance between oneself and the thought, but not trying to push the thought away, but just watching it and letting it fade away or disappear naturally. Okay, so now I'll move on to the third method. Actually, the third method seems to be closer to what I've just described. Okay, if while he is examining the danger in those thoughts, there still arise in him evil or bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hatred, with delusion, then he should try to forget those thoughts and should not give attention to them. This is what I actually recommend as the first method when, in my scheme, maybe I'll set myself up as a new Buddha. Except that I'll teach the five methods, but just in a different order. So the first method that I recommend is when the unwholesome thoughts start, is to forget about them and not to give them too much attention, but just to sort of briefly note them and then go back immediately, gently, not forcefully, not with agitation, but to go back softly and gently to one's primary object, be it the breath, rise and fall of the abdomen, bodily sensations, loving kindness meditation, whatever it might be. Okay, when he tries, and now when it says forget these thoughts, it doesn't mean, and not giving attention to them, it doesn't mean that one is not aware of the thoughts. One recognizes the thoughts, In fact, one can identify them, but one doesn't hang on to them. One doesn't flow along with them and let them become triggers for setting off streams of subsequent thinking, for initiating a sequence of associated thoughts which follow one after another until one completely loses the primary object. But simply by recognizing the thought, as soon as it arises, one simply lets it go and brings the mind back gently and firmly to the meditation object. Okay, when he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, then these bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion are abandoned and they subside, and then his mind comes to this steadied, quieted, unified, and concentrated. Then comes the simile. Just as a man with good eyes who did not want to see forms that had come within range of his sight would either shut his eyes or look away, so too this monk tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them. Okay, so if something comes within range of your sight, maybe the person wants to avoid it on the other side of the street, and you don't want to catch his attention, since he always maybe will stop you and start gossiping and waste a lot of your time. So you just, if you notice him, you just keep your eyes focused straight ahead, and this way the person won't pay attention to you. Well, this is something like a method I used to practice back in the early 1990s when I was still living in Sri Lanka, but sometimes I would come to visit my parents who were living in Long Island. And nowadays people are very, very tolerant. I never hear anybody sort of yell at me, scream at me, ridicule me for walking in the streets wearing monk's robes. But even in those days, the early 1990s, 1991, 93, whenever I would go walking on the larger roads, it's not the people on the street. People on the street always keep quiet. Maybe they talk to each, usually keep quiet. Usually they talk to each other. But it's the people driving by in cars who shout out the window. What are you, a guy or a dame? Why don't you dress like a normal person? What are you, some kind of freak? Sometimes they don't even shout intelligible words, but it would just be some kind of shout like, yeah! And sort of the trick is, what they're trying to do is to get you, in this case me, to look up and face them. If I look up and face them, they win. It's sort of, they're not aware of it, but that's the underlying psychological game. So I found how to defeat them in this game is just when I go for the walk down that busy street, just keep my attention on the touch sensation of my feet hitting the ground. So be aware of left foot, right foot. And then if anybody drives by and shouts, still keep the attention on the feet. Don't look up, and then they lose because they've shouted some offensive words or some nonsense words, and they didn't attract my attention. So they become foolish. Maybe I'm not being compassionate by making them seem foolish. but it's an instructive lesson for them in how to correct themselves. And so I would walk by just going left, right, left, right. If they shout, I just continue to focus. And then their words sort of, it's like dust thrown against the wind. The Buddha uses this in the Dhammapada. It blows back and it hits the person who throws it. But one time I was doing this, walking left, right, left, right. The car drove up beside me, started to slow down. I was thinking, uh-oh, but just keep the attention on the feet, left, right, left, right. Car drove up a little bit ahead and stopped. I thought, uh-oh, it's going to be a fight. But then I thought, you know, at a certain point I could see the figure of the man get out of the car and come walking towards me. So very cautiously I looked up, and there was a man with sort of East Asian features holding out his hands like this and saying, "Venerable, can I give you a ride someplace?" He was a man from Thailand. And I told him that I was just taking a walk. So he didn't give me his card and say, "If you need anything, just let me know." But that could have been done as quite typical in a country like Sri Lanka. Okay, so this is the method of taking note of the thought very briefly, then letting the thought go its way, and bringing the mind back to its primary object. Okay, now we come to what I would call the most interesting of these methods. And it's a little bit puzzling exactly what is meant by this. This is method number 4, and this is the method that gives its title to the sutta in the Pali version. Okay, the text says, if while he is trying to forget those thoughts and is not giving attention to them, there still arise in him these bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should give attention. First I'll read the English translation, then I'll put the Pali expression on the board. He should give attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts. This is, I would call this an approximate translation, or maybe a translation which is partly guesswork. But let's take a look at the original expression. Sort of tied down to my own meditation object here. Okay, taking this is a compound made up of 3 words that are joined together. The word vitakka is easy, that means thoughts. Then the word sankhara here, The word samkara has many meanings in different contexts, but the root meaning, or basic meaning, is something like constructing, or forming, or even fabricating, concocting, putting together. And so we could say the construction of these thoughts, the forming of these thoughts, the fabrication of these thoughts. And then the word santana, this is related to the verb that's translated becoming steady. Becoming steady, or we could say stilling, causing to stand still, causing to stop. And so we could say that putting this whole expression together, that the method is stilling the construction or fabrication or activation of these thoughts. And then to find out what is meant here, we'll just continue on till we come to the simile and see if we could apply the simile to the actual situation of training one's mind. Okay, when he gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, with delusion, are abandoned in him and subside, and then his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Okay, now the simile. Okay, we have a man who's walking fast, and somehow implicit is the idea that this man who's walking fast, he's not trying to meet a deadline to get to the office on time, but he's actually trying to find a very peaceful and quiet situation. But he's walking fast. Then he asks himself, why am I walking fast? Let me walk slowly. Then he starts walking slowly. Then he asks himself, why am I walking slowly? Let me stand still. So then he stands still. Then he says, why am I standing still? Let me sit down. He sits down. Why am I sitting down? Let me lie down. Wow, it sounds like a perfect description of me. The lazy person. Then I ask myself, why am I just lying down? Let me fall asleep. Then when the alarm goes off, why should I wake up? Let's sleep 2 more hours. Okay, so by doing this, he would substitute for each grosser posture one that was subtler. And so too, we don't get a detailed application of the simile, just a broad statement. So too, when the monk gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, then those thoughts connected with desire, hatred, and delusion are abandoned and subside. So what does this actually mean in practice? Maybe anybody would like to try to give some ideas? I don't have a fixed, well, I have my own interpretation, but I can't say that my meaning is the definitive and absolutely correct one. Just go ahead and speak.
To me, it just seems like you just have to tell yourself to stop. Just stop. It's really quite simple.
It could be that.
Which can work. But yeah. If it takes a bit of effort, it's just.
Yeah.
What I'm getting out of the whole thing is that.
Yeah, maybe it's best to take this floating microphone.
What I'm getting out of the whole thing is that basically you have to see what works for yourself. You know, in your particular mind state.
Well, that would work for the choosing which of the methods out of the five work for oneself. But how do we understand this method specifically?
For me, it suggests bringing an attitude of investigation or questioning to why am I thinking like this? Which can bring a release.
Yeah. In fact, that's one of the explanations given in the commentary. When one finds oneself thinking some distracting thoughts, one asks, why am I thinking this? Then one goes, sort of traces back the chain of thoughts. Why am I thinking that? Why was I thinking that? And as one goes on investigating, then the mind has turned away from that disturbing thought into the series of investigations. And then at a certain point, then one could just drop the investigation and go back to the primary object. So I saw some, Barbara?
There's also the technique that I've been taught of whatever is intruding, to simply label it. And one of the things is thoughts. Just observe thoughts. And it can also be feelings, it can be sounds, whatever. Just observe the thoughts.
Okay, that's good. Does somebody else have?
I see there's a why, but there's no answer to the why. First of all, I noticed that. Why am I walking fast? It's just what if. And I see there's a factor of substitution. Instead of walking fast, walking slow. But it never answered why am I. It's ignore why.
It's actually, the question is somewhat rhetorical, like the sense is, since it's the person who's looking for a quiet position, he says, what's the point in walking fast? Not, what is my reason for walking fast? Like I have an appointment, a doctor's appointment, I have to meet a friend someplace, I have to get to work on time. It's not like that there's an actual reason, but he's saying in other words, he's saying, it's pointless to be walking so fast. To be quiet and peaceful, I should slow down. Okay, so everybody has given their explanation. My understanding, and as I said, it's not fixed categorically correct one, is that when the mind is giving way to some of these disturbing or distracting thoughts, what one would do would be just to drop the primary object and just watch the thoughts themselves. And so one creates this distance between oneself and the thought and just looks at the thought and watches it. And as one watches the thoughts, one finds that the thoughts by themselves tend to sort of settle down, the stream of thought tends to settle down until the thoughts aren't occurring anymore. So the mind is just in a completely observant station, a completely observant poise, looking into itself, watching for thoughts to arise, but because one is taking this observant stance towards one's own thought processes, the thoughts have slowed down at a certain point, they stop arising. Then one can bring the mind back to the main object. In fact, a very interesting exercise in itself, which is part of, it's the development of citta anupassana, contemplation of the mind, is one would begin maybe using a focusing meditation object, like the breath, till one reaches a certain degree of concentration. It doesn't have to be a jhanic state, but just till the mind settles down and becomes fairly concentrated. Then one drops that primary object and just looks at the mind, watches the mind. Sometimes thoughts will arise, one just watches the thought arise, and lets it dissolve. Then there'll be periods where one is just in that watching position, watching, 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 but it seems nothing is occurring in the mind. Then maybe some stream of thoughts will come up. Maybe one will even get sort of carried away by the stream of thoughts until one is lost in the labyrinth of thinking. But then one remembers, I'm supposed to watch my mind. And then one goes back to the watching position. And again, the thoughts will slow down, settle down, subside, and become still. Then one will be watching the mind for some time. Then thoughts will come up again and vanish. But just when one is watching the mind, that is a kind of antidote to getting carried away by the stream of thoughts. But again, you experiment, if you want to apply this method, experiment with different methods and see what works, what you find to be effective as an interpretation of this. If you can just stop the mind with the command, stop, that's good. If you want to investigate what is the source of this thought, why am I thinking this thought, what is conditioning this thought, then you can use that approach. Or if you just want to watch the mind and watch the thoughts till the thoughts settle down, use that approach. Okay, now in my way of ordering the five methods, I begin with method number 3, then I would go to method number 4, then I would bring in method number 1, then method number 2, then finally we come to method number 5. And this shows that method number 5, that the Buddha recognized that sometimes it's necessary to be forceful. It's not the first method, but sometimes necessary. So, okay, if while he is giving attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, there still arise in him these bad, unwholesome thoughts, connected with desire, with hatred, with delusion, then, with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. Then as he does so, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion are abandoned in him and subside, and then his mind is steadied internally, brought to stillness, and concentrated. Then comes the simile, just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him, so too, again with the teeth clenched and the tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth, one beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind. So the Buddha recognizes sometimes it's necessary to use this method. It's not the first approach, not the one that one should bring in immediately when the troublesome thoughts arise, but when all of the other methods prove ineffectual, then one could bring in this kind of direct assault on the mind in order to push away those unwholesome thoughts. Okay, then just to take the concluding paragraph of the sutta. Okay, here the Buddha sort of sums up by going through all of the five methods again in brief. When the monk is giving attention to some sign, to some object, and owing to that object there arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion, then when he gives some other sign connected with what is wholesome, any such evil, unwholesome thoughts are abandoned in him and subside. then his mind is brought to become steady, steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness and concentrated. Then it's repeated when he examines the danger in those thoughts, when he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, when he gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, when he beats down and crushes mind with mind, any such evil, unwholesome thoughts are abandoned and so on, then this monk is called a master of the courses of thought. He will think whatever thought he wishes to think, and he will not think any thought that he does not wish to think. Okay, now I'm going just to read through the final sentence. He has severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with the complete penetration of conceit, he has made an end of suffering. The last sentence implies that this monk has achieved arhatship. Now, from what is contained within the sutta, there's nothing to suggest that the monk has achieved arhatship. And checking the Chinese version of the sutta, the version preserved in the Chinese Tripitaka, I found that that last sentence is not there. Apparently, that last sentence was added at a later time in the chain of transmission of the sutta, probably because the ones who preserve the suttas, everything has to end with the grand climax. It's like, you know, the hero has to beat the villain and become the promoted to be the sheriff of the town, or appointed mayor of the city, or win the love of a beautiful girl and ride off into the distance to live happily ever after. And so probably originally, based on what is found in the sutta itself, the sensible ending is with the statement that this monk will be the master of the courses of thought. He'll think whatever he wants to think and won't think what he doesn't want to think. And in a way, that shows the achievement of adhicitta, the higher mind. But in order to justify assigning arhatship, there would have to be some statement showing how he develops insight into the three characteristics, and then realizes the Four Noble Truths, and then eliminates the asavas, the taints or corruptions of the mind. Okay, so this takes us to the end of the sutta. If there's any questions, then please feel welcome to. Okay, Barbara?
Is this on?
Yeah.
With the crushing mind with mind technique, how does that work if the thoughts that have come up are about assaultiveness and anger? Can you...
Or about what?
Assaultiveness and anger. That as a...
I think...
Does that give into them?
Well, first, I think when crushing mind with mind, the attitude shouldn't be one of anger. And in my opinion, probably this method is not really intended for dealing with anger. I have to say, from my own experience, it's generally used in dealing with sensual lust. That seems to be its special sphere. Because there sometimes one has to be forceful. And what's interesting about this fifth method, when we read the biography of the Buddha as he relates it in Sutta, I think it's Sutta number 36, when he mentions that he speaks about his own past experience as an ascetic, when he went off, when he left the palace to become an ascetic. When he set out to meditate, this was the first method that he used, or one of the first methods. So he used, in an early stage, he used that forceful method. But then when he later compiled his own strategies for dealing with the mind, he didn't reject that method entirely, but he brought it in as the fifth and last method. It can be useful for sensual lust. It could also be useful for dullness and drowsiness. Sometimes just by making a really firm determination not to give way to this dull, heavy, rigid mind, one could just drive it away through determination. But I'd say for anger and for restlessness, it's not so effective. It's also effective for this, what I would call a state of doubt or perplexity. Sometimes the mind makes a lot of trouble just by raising questions, doubts. Is it this way? Should I go about it that way? What if I do this? What if I do that? If one is asking these questions because it's a matter of sensibly choosing the right strategy or right techniques to use, then it's appropriate to ask those questions. But sometimes the mind just becomes a chatterbox, casting up these questions just as a kind of malign, self-defeating way of pulling one off the track of meditation. Then one just has to make that determination, stop. That's the cure method. Stop asking those silly questions. Just fix the mind on the object and keep it there. And then that determination can be enough. Maybe it doesn't mean that one goes into perfect samadhi, but it cuts off that stream of senseless questioning and the kind of the chatterbox of questioning thoughts. Did somebody have a question?
Yeah, Bhakti, yeah. Have you literally clench your teeth, or like just something on mental thought? Is that something you physically do, or something that you do in your mind?
I don't think it's really so necessary to clench the teeth. It's just showing the sort of forceful attitude of mind. But sometimes if one adopts that forceful attitude of mind, maybe naturally the teeth tend to become a little bit clenched. Mm-hmm. And what is the other one? The teeth clenched and the tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth. I don't think one has to take that too literally.
Okay.
Why a position is considered grosser than the other position, such as the sitting position is considered grosser than the lying down position, unless it's understood in terms of the movement of the body.
Yeah, I think it's considered by way of the movement of the body.
Okay, so if it's by way of the movement of body, then the fourth method seem to me to be not a complete objective observer. It seems that one has to tell oneself to do something, like to slow down or to reduce the thoughts.
Yeah, this could be another interpretation of it. Just as the person, this is the point, just as the person who's walking will tell himself at each specific points, stop taking that grosser position and take the subtler, quieter position. So if when one is observing the thoughts, one could tell oneself, stop thinking these thoughts. Actually, then this would be similar to the method that, your name again?
Dreya.
That Dreya had recommended, just saying stop. Except here it goes in sequence rather than just as one total one command which totally obliterates the stream of thoughts. But probably one just keeps on telling oneself, stop, 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 and then the thoughts slow down until at a certain command they will stop completely, and then one can go back to the main object. Okay, let me take some of these questions off the internet. Okay, is thought formation the same as the mental formation? I think by this he means the aggregate of mental formations. Or is it referring to verbal formation related to intention of thoughts? I mean, nothing really is said very specifically about how this vitakka sankhara fits into the scheme of the five aggregates or any of these other schemes. So just, I think we should just take it in terms of the actual meaning of the words rather than to try to relate it to other schemes that we meet in the suttas. Just what I would call the activation of thoughts or the constructing or fabrication of thoughts. Okay, then the second question. These methods call upon energy or virya. Can other spiritual faculties like faith be used to develop the higher mind? Actually, I wouldn't say that these methods use exclusively energy or effort, but there's actually a combination of factors here. And I say it's primarily, it's a combination of virya, that's energy, with mindfulness, which brings greater samadhi or concentration. And so actually, and also with mindfulness, one needs clear comprehension. And so I would say energy, mindfulness, clear comprehension are all working together here. One needs clear comprehension to recognize the thoughts, to be able to identify them. One uses the sati or mindfulness, excuse me, well, let's say one brings in the virya or energy to dispel the unwholesome thoughts, and one brings in the mindfulness to keep the mind focused on its original object or to attend to the new object that one takes up. So there's a combination of factors that are used here. Okay, third question. If one asks, why am I thinking such, when one is trying to overcome the thought formations, doesn't this cause more discursive thinking to occur instead of remaining attentive to the meditation object? Maybe we could say that this is like using a vaccination to make oneself immune to a disease or to overcome a particular illness. Like the vaccine in itself, if you take it in a large quantity, it's poisonous. But if you take it in a very small quantity, it causes a kind of inner reaction, a mild reaction, that creates immunity to the disease. And so when you ask why to overcome these thought formations, it's using discursive thinking, but it's using the very mild and consciously directed discursive thinking to overcome this distracting and uncontrolled discursive thinking. Or again, it's a little bit like if one gets a big thorn in the skin, and one wants to remove it, one might use a needle to push out the thorn. Normally you wouldn't stick oneself with a needle, but if one uses the needle carefully in a directed way, you could push out, say it's a poisonous thorn that would deposit some poison into the skin that would cause a rash. So one wants to get rid of it, one uses the needle to push it out. Okay, how do other methods to overcome distracting thoughts, like counting the breaths, chanting a mantra, or switching to metta, loving kindness meditation, fit into the five methods given in the sutta? Okay, things like counting the breaths or the metta meditation, they can actually be the beginning meditation subject. And then the distracting thoughts could build up based on those meditation subjects. But one could also use them as methods for counteracting distracting thoughts. For example, as I explained earlier at the beginning of the class, counting the breaths can be a method of, if the mind is tending to stray, to become overrun by restlessness, then when one has to when one assigns oneself this task of counting the breaths, then one constantly has to be aware of the number. And so the mind becomes, you're giving the mind a little toy to play with, a sort of game to play. So it's like challenging oneself. You have to be attentive to the number. And so if the mind strays, then one will recognize it, and one has to go back to one, that's the penalty, and start over till one gets to 10 down to one. And then this helps to keep the mind back on the meditation subject. Then the metta meditation can be used to overcome ill will and anger. It's the direct antidote to ill will and anger. Chanting the mantra, in the methods that I've been trained in, we don't actually use the mantra, but if that method works, it can become, again, it's a method of having some object on which to focus the mind so it doesn't get distracted. Okay, maybe at this time we'll take a break and then we'll come back after lunch at 12 o'clock, maybe a few minutes after, for a question and answer discussion period. Then I should mention that it's at 2 o'clock, Heidi. There will be a service, interfaith prayer service today for the victims of the earthquake in Haiti and also the earthquake in Chile last week. So if anybody wishes to stay for this, you're welcome to join in and participate. And the prayer service that's organized under the auspices of BAUS, the Buddhist Association for the United States. Okay, so we'll end with the sharing the merits from meditation, speaking on the Dhamma, discussing the Dhamma. We share the merits with the deities, the dragon spirits, the Buddhas or fear spirits, asking them to rejoice in these merits, to protect the Dhamma, to protect the world, to protect ourselves and others. Well, recite in Pali. You could join in if you like. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu sasaram. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu mam param. Etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe satanumodhantu Sabba sampati siddhya bhavagupadhaya vichihetato etantare satakaya papanna rupi arupi cha sanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibbuti. I should mention that we have a class next week, and next week we'll do Sutta number 21. Those who don't have the book, it should be on the... Kaiti, did you put it on the PDF? Did I send it to you? No, so I have to send it to you.
You mean the class schedule?
The schedule, I know, but the text of the Sutta? Oh, okay, then I'll send it to you. But you... scan it in from the book, it's better. It's printed up.
Oh.
Rather than...
Actually, the Google book has most of the Google
books. Yeah, but some sutras are missing. Anyway, I'll send you the text of it.
Okay. The schedule says Sutta 22, I think. Or am I looking at the wrong schedule?
Didn't it say Sutta number 21?
Oh, it changed, okay. I have an old schedule.
An old one. Okay.
Record that you said you had found? That was mine. You know where it was?
Oh, that was yours. Thank you for reminding me. Okay, so I brought it with me, then I forgot to make the announcement.
Oh, okay, thank you.
This one?
Yes, thank you.
Also, a lot of tape recorders have been getting lost. Even this one. Parlez-vous français? No, speak.
Three echoes.